Hello, 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 and welcome to My Empty Hands, a podcast about the martial arts, typically with a focus on Kenpo, but today we're going to get into some other stuff, and got a great guest with me today. I'm Tom Kalos, and I'm excited because Mr. Kalos, he knows everybody, and he's been around for a minute, so I'm excited to get to hear his story and learn more about his journey. But we'll probably get into it as we go along. But we're kind of like ships crossing in the night. We've actually had kind of a number of connections over the years, but didn't know it, and we'll see how we get to that later on. But I usually start things off with giving my background, but since we're here for the guest, I'm not going to get too deep into it. Just say that I have advanced ranks in Kenpo, American Kenpo, and in Capoeira, and I also have some experience in Taekwondo and Hapkido, and did a little boxing while I was in the army. So that's my kind of just quick rundown of my background. But let's get into our guest. Please tell me and the listeners, you know, how did the martial arts find you? Where did it all start for you? And we'll just go from there.
Well, thanks for having me on your podcast, Reggie. And yes, looks like we crossed paths on a number of occasions. You told me there was a YouTube video I'd done in Reno in 2011. I was on my way to live in Europe and Asia for a year with my family. We only made it 6 months because the girls were missing their, you know, friends too much. But we lived in Thailand, where I trained with Master Toddy and other schools, and went to Greece and Italy and France, and of course, you know, got around Europe. But on the way through, I stopped in Reno, and I happened to see you and some people doing capoeira in the Wingfield Park. I didn't know you. I filmed and said, oh, look, there's some capoeira here. So small world. I started my first martial arts lesson was on TV in 1964 with the Green Hornet, right? And then shortly thereafter, I started punching, kicking, and throwing my little brother and sister. And I took my first informal lesson in judo in 1969 in a rec center in a decommissioned Air Force base outside of Reno. We live nearby, and I saw them practicing judo in there, and they didn't teach kids, but I would sit and watch the class, and I did it often enough that they started inviting me on and teaching me how to break fall and throw the big guys, and, you know, it was fun. Then my family moved into town, and I joined a Taekwondo school when I was 11, and that was Grandmaster Lou Grosso, who I talk to every couple weeks still. And I got my black belt 8 or 9 years later, because he didn't give black belts to kids, you know, so I turned 19. And it wasn't much longer that I had been exposed. I was fighting on the circuit, competing on the circuit in Northern California, and I met a bunch of Grandmaster Ernie Reyes's people, and I said, that's the school I got to be in. So I put all my stuff on my Honda 750 and cruised down and stayed on a friend's couch just down the street from Mr. Reyes' school. I was 19 or 20. And my classmates at the time, Mr. Reyes had like 7 or 9 of the top 10 forms competitors in the world training in this one little sweaty school, which included Cindy Rothrock and George Chung and just, you know, a who's who of performance artists at the time. And I was just in pig heaven. I got into the West Coast demo team and got to travel and compete. And it was just a mecca for martial arts. In the Bay Area, had so much going on. We'd have Anthony Chan come in with Wushu people and do Wushu. And when the World Games were in San Jose, Billy Blank showed up and we worked out with him. And then teams from South America came in and trained with us. And, you know, it was just And Mike Swain was there with the judo team at San Jose State. I mean, everybody who was anybody stopped into Mr. Reyes's and taught and trained with us. And I mean, I was just so happy. And a year or so later, I relocated back to Reno so I wouldn't starve to death in San Jose, which I was, because I wanted to train and not work. Mm-hmm. And my family had a business in Reno. So I moved back to Reno, and there was a West Coast black belt there that started a small school. I ended up taking over that school. He relocated. And not that much, many years later, I had, I think that the two schools I had in Reno were two of the largest student body wise in the United States. And I was on the board of directors of Educational Funding Company, and we were doing great business and trying all kinds of new things. And jiu-jitsu hadn't come yet. Mm-hmm. And jiu-jitsu really revolutionized how we approach the training and the attitudes on the mat, and a little South American mixed with Asian. It's been great. And I did jiu-jitsu for 25 years before I had to retire due to hip injuries. I had four hip replacements and a variety of other injuries, and I just couldn't jeopardize my ability to be mobile. Mm-hmm. But it's painful. Every time I drive by a school, a little tear comes down the side here.
Yeah, I can.
Doing one right there.
I can relate.
But anyway, so I had lots of people over the years who mentored me or that I became friends with, including my first instructor, Mr. Reyes, and all his team. And Grandmaster Junri became a friend. And I traveled with him and had him around and for seminars and such. And then everybody from John Sepulveda to Ed Parker Jr., who encouraged me to become an artist, to pursue that. And just got lucky. Teaching seminars, got to meet a lot of my heroes and peers and friends. And so I have a wide network. I just got back from L.A., where I went down for Cindy Rothrock's movie, Black Creek, which is a Western chop sake. Mm-hmm. Well done. And here you've got this pioneering, you know, senior martial artist who got the idea, raised the money, did the production, got it to the screen. It's an epic effort right there. Then the Black Belt Magazine Hall of Fame Awards were the next day, first time they'd been done outside of the magazine. Mm-hmm. And George Chung, who was a classmate of mine, of course, in San Jose, and a 45-year friend now, did a great job. But anybody who was everybody in L.A. was there. I met Dolph Lundgren and Pam Grier from, you know, the Tarantino movie. Mm-hmm. All the stunt guys that I worked with when I was in stunts with Mr. Reyes or knew about were there. That was just a kick. And two things came out of it. One is like, oh, these are a lot of friends I haven't seen for a long time. And the other one was, oh my God, I'm so happy I'm not in the entertainment business. Rough. Yeah. Anyway, that's how I got my start in training and had great jiu-jitsu training, introduced BJ Penn to jiu-jitsu. And then he proceeded to, you know, stomp on me for about a year before I took him to San Jose. First time he'd been off the islands to meet, was for Mr. Reyes's 50th birthday party. And Ralph and Caesar Gracie had a school right down the street. So I just took BJ down there and said, here, this kid's killing me. Can you just take him from there? And BJ became, won the world championships in 2.5 years, which was unheard of, you know, got his black belt in 2.5 years. Who does that? And nobody even scored a point on him. Hmm. And which is a good thing, because when I was training with him, I was getting ready for 5th or 6th down under Mr. Reyes, and I had to be in tip-top shape, and everybody was starting jiu-jitsu, so I had to continue. And one day I was really tired, and I said, BJ, let's just move a little bit, you know, slap box, see what you got. So we square off, and he hits me in the face about 19 times before I can flinch. And now I spend the rest of the workout chasing him around the dojo trying to get revenge. And I remember walking home that day. I lived just a couple miles from where we were training, and thinking, that's it. Got my clock handed to me by a 17-year-old. It's over. Because that time I'd been training about 25 years. Fortunately, he became a world champ, so I felt, took some of the sting off, you know. Mm-hmm. But the kid had the timing and the distance and the twitch speed, and he was just well ahead of his time. And I've had a good career. My sons are both jiu-jitsu black belts. Keenan is running a big jiu-jitsu academy called Legion in Sego, and my other son, Shannon, teaches jiu-jitsu and trains in Reno,
where I used to live. Very nice, very nice. So they didn't catch the taekwondo bug?
You know, I was really into jiu-jitsu, so taekwondo's run its course. You know, I was starting to have hip and back pain, and jiu-jitsu helped me prolong my career for another 15 years because I could do jujitsu without the extreme flexibility that I needed, and my hips were just giving me grief. And, you know, everybody and their brother's getting them replaced now, but at the time it was uncommon. And I had them both done at 40 the first time, and had 15 good years of athleticism afterwards. But then I was getting ready to fight in the Senior Master Worlds as a brown belt. I was already 24 years in, you know, but a slow learner. And my instructor was my age and still competing and winning. So I said, okay, I got to get out there. So I registered, and of course you register in advance. They publish the brackets. You could see who you're going to fight. I Googled them. One of them was a judo champ. So I said, I better be ready for that. Next class, I spiral fractured my femur with a fake hip in there. So my foot's behind my head. Oh. People are turning green around the school. One guy started that week, never came back.
My goodness.
And found out that was a result of the installation of the hips caused something called particle disease, which is when the parts they put in at the time started to disintegrate. Small pieces get in around the bone. Your body attacks it. Can't get rid of the pieces, but it eats the bones, so your bones go to mush. And the doc said it's mush. You know, it's smelly mush. And that's why my femur broke, and that's why I had to get the fourth hip replacement to replace the old parts in the left. So I have several body parts that are still uniquely mine, but most of them have been replaced. And it's affected my ability to train with the vigor that I like to. So now I'm mostly doing martial arts in yoga and my strength training and in my head. And I transferred what I've done on the mats to making art, because it keeps me from going completely mad.
Gotcha.
As I miss the Zen aspects of combat.
Yeah, no, I bet. I mean, I'm over the moon over the handful, and I say handful of martial arts celebrities, or just celebrities in general that I've met, and you know, you've been exposed to all of them. I think it would be easier.
I got lucky.
And to say, yeah.
I was at the Martial Arts Museum while in L.A., and I was joking to someone that you know, you're getting a little older when everybody in the museum you go into are friends of yours, you know? Yeah. Okay. But it's been a great ride, and I'm still a martial artist, but I've had to face the question, you know, what are you? What is the training brought to you when you can no longer kick somebody in the head? You know, what is left over and how do you use it? And I think that's been the gift of the transition in my training, is that I had to really evaluate, okay, so you've trained in martial arts 50 years, you know, what do you know? What can you do? Are you now not a martial artist because you can't go out and fight the black belts, or because you're not competing, or because you're not advancing in rank, or is there some other... What is the essence of what you picked up, and how are you using it in your life to the benefit of yourself and others? So it's been a good thing in that way. This last year, my wife was diagnosed with cancer. So we spent a good year fighting it, and she's now in remission. But it made me reflect on the gift of cancer, which is when you're faced with something that's life-threatening, it makes you appreciate life more. So you become more present. So I went, when I was running a program called the Ultimate Black Belt Test, and I did it for about 10 years, and it was a year-long program where people would voluntarily come in and do all these tasks, and they could custom design it. And I just wanted a black belt test, that an experimental test that where we could try new things out, because I'd seen so many black belt tests that were rather disappointing. They were either hazings or, you know, participants didn't look like they'd really prepped. And so I said, let's try something new. But one of the lessons that I emphasized when I was working with all these 30 to 100 people would show up at a time for the test, which was we'd all engaged in for 12 months, was the real gift of what you've learned and a real skill as a martial artist is learning how to turn the bad into the good. Because we were going to this little rural town in Alabama to build homes and to renovate properties. Half the people who came had never swung a hammer. And we were sleeping on the floor of a gym, and it was real hardship in some ways, a real gift in others. But I just had to reframe everybody to say, you know, no matter what happens to us here, we're representing the martial arts. I want these people to look at us when we're gone, go, my God, those people are amazing. Their attitudes, you know. So no matter what happens, if the floor is hard or the food's cold or, you know, you're dirty and wet or whatever, you go, this is great. Turn the bad into the good. And that's maybe something that anybody listening to this can take away, no matter where you're at, you know, injuries or attitude or responsibilities, your job, your training was in part designed to take a bad situation, someone trying to punch you in the head, and turn it into something that's more to your advantage, you know? And that has to go off the mats and into the world for you to be a real, you know, martial artist, not just on the mats, but in your life and facing your hardships and struggles and opportunities.
Yeah, I agree. It encompasses your whole life, and yeah, it's not just, you know, what you're doing in the studio, in the dojo, in the on the mat. It's everything. It's your thought process, your how you connect with people, just every yeah. aspect of your life.
It's true. And the things that, but it isn't always, you know, I know a lot of guys who are really good on the mats, not so good in life, you know. And I think it's up to instructors, those of you who are watching this or future instructors, you know, when you're watching somebody make a fist and they do something wrong, you patiently and repetitively remind them how to do the move right, because that's how you teach. And you're not surprised when somebody does it again. You're like, hey, I told you that 2 months ago. You know, you just, hey, put that on the end, whatever it is. And likewise with this idea of taking what we're practicing right now, focus, the concentration, the teamwork, the friendship, the focus you have, those things have to be applied to other parts of your life. You know, you don't get in fights here in the studio. You don't get in fights outdoors. You treat each other with respect in here formally. You do it outside. You know, remind people that the real goal of the work is not to learn how to punch, kick, or choke people. The real work is to learn how to be a more high-functioning human being, you know, that makes contribution, not just about you, but about how you and your work affect the people in your sphere of influence. You know, like Adbusters was this anti-consumerism magazine, and they had this great thing about a black spot. If you wore a shirt with a logo in it, they'd put a black spot on it because you're not representing the company. And it was, you know, it was a little bit of, you know, uppity non-consumerism ideas. But I thought that would be a good black belt test. Put a black dot over the person who's testing. And like a black hole, they can't see black hole. They can only see how it affects things around them. So the same thing, if we put a black dot on you, how has your work affected your children and your mate and your community and the world at large? You know, that would be the real test. Can't even see what you're kicking, punching, or breaking, only the influence you've had on others. And that is something that I worked on very hard and think is very important, but not often talked about in our communities.
Very nice. So to kind of stay on the teaching theme and take it back a little bit, for the teaching aspect, was that something that you were always interested in, or did that come along, you know, later on down in your training, or you know?
No, I knew the first day I walked into Mr. Grasso's school and watched the class. I said, this is what I'm going to do. I don't know why. You know, it could have been, my parents would have appreciated if it had been law school or medical school, but you know, that was my thing, as many of you can relate to. And it just happened. But the nature of schools is that you not only learn how to do your martial arts, but you learn how to participate with those around you. So teaching for many schools, as everybody here watching knows, becomes a part of it because it helps you learn what you're trying to learn. By teaching, you start to recognize things you wouldn't recognize maybe if you weren't trying to get somebody else to do it or encouraging them. So it has a lot of value. But I'd like to point out that one of the things that I've realized as a teacher over time is that you can't teach what you don't know. Exactly. You know, and when we're in a martial arts school and we're not talking about, take for example, which is my, you may have heard me talk about this before, diabetes. 1 in 3 children are expected to be affected by diabetes in the next decade, either directly or indirectly. But we're not talking about it in our schools, even though it's probably more self-defense relevant than is, you know, somebody punches you here and you move your hand like this, because we don't know that much about it. If we knew about it, if we were experiencing it, if we were living it, and we knew that 1 in 3 kids could be affected by type 2, which is preventable, we might say something. You know, if you knew that a bunch of bullies were waiting out front and you knew your student was going to walk right out and they were going to, you know, thrash him, wouldn't you say something? Or would you say, oh, I'm only responsible for this box, what he does outside, that's up to him. You know, of course you'd say, let's go out the back door. Or here, let me grab a couple guys, we'll go out and you know, calm this down. But same thing with diabetes or COPD or suicide or all the things that actually kill people in the world. Of the top 10 killers, punching, kicking, and getting choked are not on the list. It's suicide, diabetes, and COPD, as I mentioned, and other preventable things, auto accidents and gun violence. And so when we're teaching, we talk about those things or we don't talk about them because we've either been studied the issues or been involved in them or we haven't. And so it's up to every instructor watching this to say, well, why don't we teach these things? So it's because I can't talk about it intelligently, diet or nonviolent conflict resolution or anger management, because I haven't done an iota of research on it. And when I go to the conventions, it's all technical or sales. There's no class there about anatomy and physiology or injury prevention, or we have a deficit there. So it's up to the instructor to go out and learn those things. And you'll have a better Kenpo, you'll have a better Taekwondo or Jiu-Jitsu when you know more about things that your teacher may have inferred but didn't actually teach you. And you'll have a better school if you can talk about anger management, because many conflicts, many violent conflicts, start with someone losing their cool and not having been, you know, if you get involved in a domestic violence or some kind of violence in public where you're arrested, you're often sentenced to go to anger management training. Well, that's not self-defense, is it? After the fact, self-defense is avoiding a dangerous situation before it happens. So anyway, that's my take on teaching.
Gotcha. No, I like that. And, you know, it goes back to what we were talking about before, about the training in the arts covers the whole life. And yeah, we can learn whatever kicks, punches, but also learning about the other things and learning about health, learning about all of that contributes into, you know, being a better martial artist, being a better person. You know, all of those need to connect in as well. And we need to be, you know, reaching out for those other things too, and not just, you know, not just the kicking and punching and grappling and all of that. There's all of those pieces. Yeah.
I don't think of martial arts. I just stopped thinking about martial arts because to me, instead of saying martial arts, I just said life. Because of the pie, you know, martial arts is such a small slice of it. There's so much more. And so when I think martial arts, I think life. And when I think martial artist, I think human being. So the goal is not to be a great martial artist, because it's such a small and inconsequential goal. The hard goal is to be a great human being. And we don't want to have martial arts be, you know, it's not martial arts that we're training in. It's about life. And there's a saying that came from one of the last living students of Ueshiba. I've forgotten his name at the moment, but he said, he mentioned one of his books that he heard this saying, "My life is my dojo." And I thought, oh, I'm stealing that, you know?
Yeah, no, that's very, very accurate. So I like that. I like that. So to kind of roll back to those earlier days, how was it, you know, there wasn't a lot of, you know, there wasn't kids classes and such back in the day. And, you know, as you were, you know, training in the judo in the early days and the taekwondo, did you get a sense or was there kind of like a, I don't know, you had to kind of prove yourself to the adults? Because, you know, I'm sure that a lot of the adults at the time were like, you know, like, we're letting this kid hang around. Or
we had kids classes. So, you know, it wasn't as popular maybe as today, but we there were kids in the classes. And I remember, I just loved the whole thing. I didn't really excel in school. You know, I came from a family with seven kids. Our parents were in a bit of turmoil and school was just such a headache, you know? And, I already knew everything anyway. So, but the organization, the militaristic, you know, the lining up and the standing still and all these things were so good for me. And I really ate it up. And so, I don't remember, you know, anything more than just taking it in as you can as a kid. You know, you take things hook, line, and sinker. You don't disbelieve what, you know, I'm watching Kung Fu. He's kicking knives out of in the bar room and they're sticking in the ceiling. I'm thinking, I'm going to do that, you know. And only later when you, you know, have to face a little more reality do you realize, oh, maybe some of these things were not reality, you know. But I took it hook, line, and sinker. I read all the books. I read every magazine cover to cover. I knew because of Karate Illustrated and Black Belt and all these magazines, I knew, you know, fighting arts. I knew who was who and, you know, Jeff Smith and all those, Howard Jackson and Bill Wallace and all guys who became my friends were my heroes and inspiration. And I'm sure I studied the martial arts magazines like a lot of you have. More than I studied English, math, and science, you know.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. I still got my stack of Black Belt and Inside Kung Fu magazines.
Yeah.
I need to break those out and take a look at them now that I've had some opportunity to kind of talk to some of the people that were in those magazines and in the Panther videos that I like to bring up and date myself as well, Panther production videos. It's kind of unreal to me.
Yeah,
that
you could go back to play with your abacus once in a while, you know. I think one of the biggest transitions for me was the people I was hanging out with. When I moved from Reno to San Jose and started training with Grandmaster Ernie and all his people, what he gave me was this sense of, yes, we can. We can do grand things. You know, we can be who we're watching. We can be the heroes. We can perform and wow. And it opened a door to possibilities, whereas the school I'd come from, which was a great school, it was really about fundamentals. So when I moved to San Jose, and I was one of the better guys in my school, I was super rigid, you know, like I had all the form down, you know, perfect, could walk up and down, do basics, do the katas. But Mr. Reyes, his group had flow. They just flowed from move to move, you know, and that just opened the door of, you know, it reminds me today that you really have to be mindful. It's really self-defense to be mindful of who you spend your time with, because they can have such a profound effect on your attitude, your goals, your ambitions. And moving to San Jose to be with this team just opened the door of possibilities. Movies, sure. You know, musical form, sure. world champion sparring, let's do it. Taekwondo, kickboxing, whatever it was, there was somebody at Mr. Reyes's in the group that was just at the in the top 1%, and it was exciting. And I really have a debt of gratitude to Mr. Reyes and all the people who were part of the teams back then, because I was like a kid who got a free pass and money to be at Disneyland.
Exactly, exactly. So being around, you know, all these notable people, did you get into, it's both the competition side and since a lot of these, competitors use that to transition into, TV and movies and stuff like that. Was there, did you get into any of those areas?
Yeah. Or? Heated up and down the circuit. I fought a lot of the up and comings, got my butt kicked by people like Dan Anderson and Billy Blanks and Satch Williams, and just competed as much as I could, had hundreds of trophies, but I was pretty much a third or fourth place guy. I'd occasionally take grand champion first or second, but when I'd line up and there'd be, Stuart Kwan and Cindy and George and Gary Nakahama and Belinda Davis and all these top forms competitors who were rated, and I'd be there. And I'd just be thinking, I'm just so lucky to even be in this line, And I went to Europe and fought in the European Karate Championships, which that year were held in Argos, Greece. And I my family's Greek, so I went back and met all my aunties and uncles for the first time. And I went 6 weeks early to acclimate for the fight, and I gained 22 pounds eating Greek food and force fed upon me by my relatives. And I went to the fight a little fat, but I had fun. But yeah, I loved competing. And the last competition I did were I took third place. I was gifted third place in the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu World Masters competition. But I competed the exact day that I'd broken my leg, femur, spiral fracture, 12 months before. Mm. And I didn't fight really great, but I didn't break my leg again. And I survived.
That's a win.
That was my last tournament.
That is definitely a win. very nice. So then what about, once again, being around these famous folks, so was there any desire or calling to maybe get into the TV or movies or?
Well, I did. I got to be a stuntman and have speaking parts in a lot of Ernie Reyes projects. And so the reason he would invite the main people on the demo team is because it cut rehearsal time, because we had all these routines that we worked out when we did performances live or on stage. And so rehearsal time was cut to a minimum, because as soon as I threw a punch at Ernie, he knew what his thing was going to be. Mm-hmm. And he knew we wouldn't hurt Ernie Jr. because, you're just amped up, testosterone, all that, and endorphins when you're young like that and the camera goes. But I eventually got in the Screen Actors Guild, but I realized that I was gifted all the parts that I was given. Mr. Reyes just called us in. I'd go to the airport. They'd pick me up in a limo. It was really like going to another planet. But I was in the school where Karate Kid was filmed. We were doing an episode of Sidekicks, the ABC TV series. I brought some kids from Reno to be extras in this scene where they were in a classroom. And while we were waiting, because there's a lot of waiting around in Hollywood, one of the actors comes up, a really good-looking guy. I'd seen him in something. And he said, "Hey, would you read some lines from me?" Assuming that I'm an actor there, which I would have said, "Yes, I'm an actor." So he starts reading his line. And as he's reading, I have to look up at him because it's so real. It's so over the top, like he's in it, that I'm just stunned. And then it's my turn to read, and he looks at me and goes, "Blind." And I'm like, "Oh, Joe," I realized at that moment, "You are not an actor, all right?" And then I was living in Reno, and I got a casting call because I was in SAG for High Mountain Rangers, which was Robert Conrad and his kids. They were running a show up in Tahoe, and they were doing a casting call for a bartender. So I drive up to South Lake to do the audition, and I remember walking into the lodge where they were doing it and sitting there waiting to do the same audition were like 12 Brad Pitts, you know, beautiful men, you know, just actor, beautiful hair. And I'm like, yeah. And I couldn't hardly remember one line, you know, like I had to say line. They said, Joe, do you want a whiskey or something like that? And I realized when I left there, you're not an actor. You have a Screen Actors Guild card, but you're just lucky. So I was lucky to get down there and see what it was like. And it's a hard business. And watching, you know, Ernie Jr. was amazing. He'd get a full script, like a book of lines for the show that day, and he'd memorize it within an hour. Minutes. He'd have all the script, and I couldn't remember a single line. It was a test of everybody's abilities, for sure, being in a high production, you know, high value TV show where, you know, there's 100 people behind the camera. It's a trip. And my heart goes out to anybody working in Hollywood. You know, it's tough.
Yeah, no, I don't even think I could get being past the starstruck. So, you know, for me, I'm trying desperately, and maybe you can put in a good word for me. I'm trying to get Cynthia Rothrock on the show, because I met her back in the 90s,
she'll get on. She's just the busiest person on the planet.
Yeah.
She's not underwater somewhere diving with sharks. She's making movies. She's teaching seminars. She'll just keep on her. She's a really good soul. And she'll reach out to you if you are persistent enough.
Yeah. No, she was very nice, but I won't get into the story now. But I desperately want to talk to her about the time when we met. And it took a while for me to just even be able to start talking to her when I saw her. I was like.
Yeah. Well, she's a gracious soul and really present and just living the dream. You know, she's doing exactly what she wants. And to have a female do her own film, do funding, conceive the idea, execute it, get it on the screen. I mean, for anybody, that's a hard thing to do. There's so many people trying to make films and to get it started and all the way to fruition. I mean, she deserves every accolade she gets, because that's a tough business, and she succeeded in getting that film made. It'll be the most likely the beginning of other films she makes, and she's still learning and active and vibrant and good guest.
No, she's something else. She's always been a big inspiration for me as far as just martial arts. Her abilities are, you know, still awe-inspiring. And
we have so many that are just so talented. Arlene Lemus and, you know, Karen Shepherd.
She will be on the show. She has agreed to be on the show. So we're just working on getting that. Karen Shepherd.
Graciela is a good one too. And we just have a lot of talented friends and who are good people. Graciela blows my mind. She's got her PhD and, you know, teaches at a university and does counseling. And at the same time, she's teaching martial arts seminars, and she's getting recognition for being a world boxing champion, you know, that just solid, total martial artist, mentally, physically, spiritually, emotionally, good people. Mm-hmm. As you know, who's here in town is Linda Lee, lives here, Bruce Lee's widow, and John Sepulveda, and Chris Kent is here in town, a big JKD guy. And we have a 10th red belt in jiu-jitsu who lives in town, Jiu-Jitsu. So there's just a ton of people out there, and the martial arts overall in the nation, is the quality has just gone up due to the migration from Brazil and the sharing of ideas and the video that we get to see. You know, when I was coming up, you looked at Black Belt Magazine, one frame here, another frame there. Now you can see the best people in the world doing their stuff online and you can watch it repetitively until you figure it out. You know,
it's
for sure. Changed the quality of martial arts in the world.
Yeah, thank goodness. It's both a blessing and a curse. Sifu YouTube, Master YouTube. It's like you can get a lot of good stuff. You can get a lot of not good stuff. Got to kind of take it as you go.
Not much different than literature. You know, there's lots of books out there. Some are going to catch you. Some aren't worth taking the time to read, and some will change your life. And so you just have to make distinctions, you know. But I think compared to when I was coming up, you know, I can see Wallace, I could see Norris, I could see anybody, any top champion from today doing their forms and take the best ideas or the fighting. It's just, or connecting with trainers, you know, mm-hmm. being able to just call somebody and go train at their school, you know, or become a student because they're easy to reach, you know. Back in the day, you know, you either traveled there, knocked on the door, or you weren't going to reach anybody because it was just, everybody was just separated. And now we're all so in each other's business, you know, improve yourself by watching video. But don't let me get off on a tangent here. I know everybody
I'm the king of tangents, so that's that's fine. And you know, it's my show, so we can go whatever direction we want to go. You know, I was curious. So you know, since you've been in the arts for a long time, kind of what are your thoughts in regards to just kind of how things have changed over the years, especially with the rise of MMA, and you know, are things heading in a good direction, a bad direction, or just kind of what are your thoughts on how things have changed over the years?
Well, there's always bad and there's always good. You can't have one without the other, yin yang, right? And so there are things about the martial arts community today that could be improved, and there's lots of amazing and remarkable people doing amazing and remarkable things. So you just have to try to use your common sense to decide how to proceed. But we have so much information and people are so accessible. It's good. Do I like I think that MMA, you know, it's interesting, but it's very violent, and that's where it belongs. Violence belongs in the ring, not in the home, not on the streets. You know, let these athletes who train to fight with the referees and an appreciative audience and the rules go out there and knock each other silly. That's where violence belongs. And these people are trained and professionals. No innocents are being hurt, you know. So I think MMA has a place in the world. And there's a time and a place. You know, there's that Neil Young song, Comes a Time, you know. So there comes a time when you're picking that baby off the ground, and there's times when there comes a time when you're, you know, you're letting go. And I think there's a certain age group that deals with MMA. I was talking to Hicks and Gracie not too long ago, and we were talking about how most schools are run by young men and women who really don't have much experience. You know, they don't know their butt from a hole in the ground like they will later, but they have the enthusiasm and the stamina and the passion. And as you age, when you finally have enough rubber off your tires to give good advice, you don't have the stamina to roll five classes back to back with every student. And, you know, even standing 2 hours, you know, when you've had four hip replacements, bending up and bending down, the next day you're like, oh my God, did I get in a fight yesterday? Or so it's just the nature of the beast. There's a certain age group that does MMA. They're going to be out there. They've got testosterone. They're ready to put it up. Hopefully they'll take their experience of facing their fears and succeeding under pressure and doing the training and preparation. And when they're retiring from the ring, they'll take those things into their business and their family and into solving some of the world's problems. You know, that's when martial arts would really, you know, that's when we get our biggest kudos, when you see a martial artist who isn't involved in physical conflict, is involved in inspiration and problem solving and peace education and all those things that we need to have in our toolbox to have a more peaceful, better and more peaceful world, which ironically was in the book I was given when I joined in 71. It was one of the statements, the purpose of Taekwondo is to build a better and more peaceful world. Well, that sounds great, but how does it happen? It happens because we take our work, the concentration, the focus, the discipline, the camaraderie and all that off those mats and put it to work in our communities in ways that have nothing to do with punching, kicking, or choking anybody, but that deal with the world's problems proactively. Our job is self-defense, not therapy. You don't go teach somebody about rape defense, ideally, after they've been raped. It's prevention. This is how to avoid these situations, and here's what you do. And our job is not to enforce the laws or to carry out the sentencing or to pass judgment on criminals or anybody. Our job is in saying, hey, this could happen. So let's talk about how to avoid it. And so you don't have to block a punch because you avoid the conflict in the first place. And we're really the prevention people. And that gives us license to go into our communities and talk about things that are killing people, to talk about things that are dangerous, and not to be there. Because when somebody gets hurt or there's a conflict or an assault, everybody's up in arms and aghast. It's too late. You know, you can't save somebody who's already been murdered. You know, they're not coming back. Our job as martial artists is not like law enforcement, not like the legal system. Ours is prevention. We go in with those little kids and we start talking to them about having a good attitude and smiling in the face of conflict and pressure and learning to overcome and stick to things and all those things that might actually save somebody when put to the test.
Sure. I like it. So there are, you know, there's so many, so many things I want to cover with you, and you know, we'll definitely have to do, you know, multiple episodes. But I do want to cover, you know, a little bit of, you know, not just the martial arts, but also if you could talk a little bit about, you know, the artwork that you do. You know, like you mentioned, Ed Parker Jr. Also, is, you know, amazing artist.
He really encouraged me, you know, which was great. But one of my classmates, Soojin Lee, in the West Coast demo team, was an artist. And so I hung out with him a lot, and I started to see what he was doing, and he gave me some tools and invited me in, and that became the beginning of making art. I had an appreciation for art already. I had been writing artists and reading the art news in America, but I was more of a spectator versus a participant. And when I broke my leg 8 years ago, I picked those tools up to keep from going nuts because I needed to do something. And it's not the art so much that is noteworthy because it evolves. It's what making the art does for my head, that I get the same kind of singular focus that you do when you're fighting. You can't think about what just happened or what you're going to do four or five moves now. You got to be with right there in the present. And I committed myself to making 1,000 portraits. I'm mostly a portraitist in the method that I use. And that's a martial arts thing. You know, like, I understand that with enough repetition, coming back to the gym every day, regardless of what happened the day before and where you want to be, and just re-engaging the work and going at the practice again, that's the value. And that's why I said 1,000 portraits, because what other way is there to learn? You know, it just like in jiu-jitsu or kempo or any style, no one workout changes your life. Usually it doesn't make a difference. It's cumulative. And whether you're an artist or a scientist or a parent or involved in any other activity that requires refined skills, ideally, it's repetitive practice. And when you can learn to love the practice, and not get so caught up in what the end product is. It's important, but it's not as important as being present and mindful about how you're doing the work. And you do that every day enough, and you become a black belt, or you become an artist, or you become whatever it is you set your mind to, but you don't give up after 3 heartfelt tries, or 30, or 300. You know, you stick at it until you figure out what there is to learn. And I think that's, in the essence, that's what every instructor was telling us about martial arts. Might not have been as articulate, or, you know, had the words, but that was being taught in the periphery of what we were doing.
Yeah, very well said. I like it.
I think that how we should be selling lessons, you know, is you should, like any artist, any graphic artist, painter, printmaker, architect, writer, you have to produce work. And you don't, you go to hire an artist or you go to hire an architect, you don't hire them and give them money based on their words or their advertising. Oh yeah, we'll do the best job. You have to see the work. You want to sell your work as an artist? Show me the work. And it's either meets my like, I like it or I don't. And that's something we're not doing in the martial arts. You know, we're advertising with the same words as the school down the street, as the school across the country, because we're all hiring the same people to write our copy for us. And there's some formulaic process for sales that everybody accepts as reality. And so we're all saying the same things, showing the same video, doing the phrase. You know, I don't think that's the best that we can do. We should be showing people what the martial arts does for our students. And that would be what I call a project portfolio. Let me show you how this 9-year-old who's been training with me for a year has taken his or her martial arts and look what they're doing at home and look what they're doing in their school and look what they're doing in the community. In the end, whether that kid can punch or kick has so little value in comparison to how high functioning they are. Do they know how to set goals, gather resources, get people to help them, be a part of a team, be a team leader? All those things that benefit us so much in our careers or our pursuits. That's a good school that's open for a while, like a good painter who's been doing his or her craft, should have a big portfolio to show you. What kind of houses do I build? Let me show you. And we go through. And as the buyer, you either say, oh, I love that. I want that. Or you say, you know, this doesn't really fit my groove, but you should have evidence. Go open 10 martial arts school websites after you're done listening to this, and look to see if any of them have any portfolio of how their teaching is making a positive impact in the world. Not promises. We're a promise-based industry. We have to be an evidence-based industry. We should be recording. Because you see things as a teacher, those little triumphant 6-year-old or the 45-year-old who hadn't exercised since high school is back in and doing it. You see these things, and you can't assume that the whole community just knows it. If you don't broadcast it, if you don't tell the story and why it's important and meaningful, if you aren't able to articulate those things and show them, who's going to know? It's like being a great singer but only singing in the closet in your house. You know, you got to get out in the public. So this kind of podcasting, people who are in our industry need to learn to communicate in words, in writing. Writing is the most important, because when you put this podcast online, the internet's not going to know what it is until you describe it in words. It can't tell whether we're talking about pigs or martial arts. So writing for the martial arts teacher is a skill. And I've had so many say, oh, I can't write. You better learn how to write. Because if you don't communicate what it is that you know and do to your community, they're never going to know the value. And nobody's going to be able to do it for you like you can. And that's, again, we're back to you teach what you know. If you're an artist, or you came up as a fry cook, or you were an engineer, or you love poetry, or you're a musician, those things should be affecting your teaching. You know, you bring in what you know. You won't get somebody who's not an artist talking about art in their school with any conviction, because they don't really know it. I'd like to see more martial arts schools be less Kempo, Taekwondo, Jiu-Jitsu, and more about the skills and education of the teacher. So we have to become, we have to educate ourselves in regards to nutrition, things that affect people's health, which is the ultimate self-defense. You know, what good is it if you know how to break a bone if you, if your diet's so bad that you're killing yourself, you know? Or we have to educate ourselves about nonviolent conflict resolution, you know, and make sure those kids leave our schools with some really solid tools in their toolbox to avoid conflict, thus potentially violence, and to recognize dangerous situations before they get dangerous. That's why I don't go into Western bars, you know, and kick over the Harleys in the front of the of the bar. You know, there's just some things you just don't do. You don't want to get hurt.
It's, you know? Great.
It's not that I'm not tough enough to fight them all. I just, you know, it just takes one knife or gun or two or three guys, and you're no longer a hero. My friend Alex Gong, who was a Muay Thai guy, had a school in San Francisco, a Fairtech school. He got shot in the face. Not a single thing Muay Thai can help you with when you pull out a gun, and he could have avoided that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that part of education and martial arts, that's something we could all spend more time on and try to give some tools to the people who train with us and reminders. You know, I just saying champions don't have to be told what to do. They just need to be reminded. And that reminding of, you know, be present, be here, recognize what you're learning, take it out and use it. You know, Junri helped me to become a better driver because one time, and of course, my dad probably told me the same thing 100 times, but it's hard to learn from people you don't respect, you know, and there's a time in your life when your dad is like, yeah, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But Junri says it, and it's in your head, in your heart.
Yeah. Right.
And he said, you know, when I'm driving my car and somebody cuts me off, I always control my temper and I wave, you know, I don't get upset. And that way I practice my martial arts when I'm driving. And from that day on, it was like I'd gone to driving school. I was a better driver. And until to this day, I don't drive erratically. I'm peaceful. When somebody is in a bad place, you know, and giving me the finger or I cut them off or whatever, I just think, I wonder what's causing that person to be so stressed out. And instead of, who do they think I am? That's the potential we have as teachers, to say the right thing at the right time when you have these students who just ingest it and take it in and it becomes a part of their life. So I would, when I was teaching instructors, I'd say, well, if I sit in your school and I watch your classes and you've got your best teachers out there teaching, maybe it's not the master teacher, it's somebody he or she's trained, what are they saying? You know, and I would, because the lessons you're teaching are more important than, oh, they did 400 kicks in that class. It's the message you give that the parents absorb on the side, that they're saying, yeah, nonviolent conflict resolution, that's a good thing. How do you go about that? You know, oh, I learned that, you know, and they use it the next day in their office. Instead of getting in a conflict, they and the kids are learning it and they're accepting it as their reality. And those are the gifts that we can give our students, and the kicking and punching. I mean, really, who cares if it's this or this or a sidekick? It's not what you do. It's how you go about the work and how it does more than just serve you. Our martial arts should serve our communities. We're a species that has to get along and cooperate and be at peace with each other, ideally. So that's our role. We're not the main teacher, but we're part of the village that helps people cope in the world with the idea that we don't resort to violence, that we use self-control, that we respect honor and truth and mentorship and all those things that are part of the martial arts that we just accept but don't often talk about enough because we maybe we haven't explored it or we don't have the vocabulary with it. So being on this show helps me to spread my ideas, and in turn, many of them are things that I've learned by sitting and listening to other instructors, and they just became a part of my life. So it's part of the pay it forward thing.
Very nice. Yeah.
I want to thank you for letting me yap in your ear for an hour.
No, thank you so much for being on. Like I mentioned, you know, we'll definitely have to do some more of these. I love your insights, and there's definitely a bazillion stories that we could get into, and so we'll definitely have to make that happen. But I thank you for that, for sharing all
before
of that.
We say goodbye, let me just remind everybody that there is no Kenpo, there is no Taekwondo, there is no Jiu-Jitsu, there is no state of California or border line between Nevada and California. Those are things we made up to help organize and administrate. But those lines really don't exist. And Kenpo, Taekwondo, Jiu-Jitsu, those are brand names that people applied to what they were doing to try to differentiate themselves from other things. But they don't actually exist. What our martial arts is our experience and our education. That transcends the names of our styles. And we might use a name of a style to organize our thinking or to describe what we know, but it can be limiting if, you know, it's basically the essence of JKD is that, you know, it's trying to transcend the borders of our descriptions of what we do and be higher functioning, be something else other than just whatever attributes were applied to that particular brand name, but to be able to accept, you know, not to be a style, but to accept all things and use what you feel is right for you and to try to evolve, you know, so that in the end, you're not a martial artist. You're just a freaking great human being. And you cultivate that in the people around you because they in turn help you. You know, you think you're teaching your students, right? It's they're teaching you. And just takes a while to realize that, you know. And so if you're watching today, thank you for letting me bend your ear for an hour. And also, you know, we're just at the cusp of an entirely new kind of revolution of how we use martial arts in the world. And now more than ever, our services are needed because people are in conflict, there's division in our country, and we have to, at a very grassroots level, talk about, teach, and preach about how to get along and how to diffuse violence and conflict and how to be confident and how to start something and stick to it long enough to finally get the benefits from it and all those things that are part of our martial arts journey. We need that in the world today. And so everybody should be invigorated, like, oh, you know, out of the mud comes the lotus, right? Out of this conflict we're having in the world, we become potentially more important if we embrace the teaching and go deeper and try to be the change that we, you know, we want to see in the world. Anyway, thanks, Reggie, for having me on, and thank you, everybody, for listening.
Very, very nice. Very, very well said. So, so before I let you go here, we'll kind of throw out the order a little bit, and we'll modify it. But you know, hey, we'll just go with how we're going here. So, you kind of my last kind of things that I typically in the show with is kind of what I call my lightning round there. So I got a few little questions to throw at you. First one being, do you have a favorite technique? So since you're not a Kenpo person, this works a little bit differently, but just any, you know, movement or I don't know, anything that you would classify as a technique.
I had a lot of things that I did, but I don't have a favorite technique except mental. And that is when something's difficult, I tell myself that I'm learning and that I like it. Because I learned that you have to embrace the suck. Because a lot of jiu-jitsu is about getting squished and choked and ply, you know. And if you don't like it, if you can't train yourself to enjoy it, like making art or working on cars or whatever it is, you're not going to be there very much longer. You know, you might make it a year, but you have to learn to love the stuff you don't like. So that's a technique I use all the time, because when I'm uncomfortable or upset or, you know, frustrated, right away that kicks in. And I'm like, okay, that means that I'm going to learn something. It's going to get better. You know, this belief system I adopted, that's a technique, as is when somebody's not behaving very well. They're in your face, they're flipping you off as they drive by, they were rude in the restaurant, whatever it is. There's a technique that I learned from, I'm going to say it was Dave Kovar or Tony Robbins, I can't remember. And it was, you ask yourself, well, I wonder what's going on in that person's life that's causing them to be stressed out like that. And it was Tony Robbins, because he said, the quality of your life can often be dictated by the quality of the questions you ask yourself. And so I would teach kids, I'd say, when somebody's rude to you or trying to create conflict, the question isn't, well, who do they think I am? Am I some punk they can just pick on? That's not an empowering question, because that makes you defensive. Instead, learning to ask yourself questions like, something must be off in this guy's life. You know, there's under some pressure that I don't know about that's causing them to behave poorly. And your body language changes, and how you approach the subject changes, your feelings about it change. And it's a great way to reduce stress or conflict in a situation where there's stress and conflict. And so those kind of techniques, which mirror physical techniques, are the kinds that I embrace and use today, because I haven't had much opportunity to punch anybody in the face or to get them in a rear naked choke. You know, those things are few and far between, if non-existent. But diffusing conflict and all those things, I have to practice those things every day, especially in today's political environment, because I get triggered just like everybody else. I'm like, you know, if you follow me on Facebook, you've seen I've been blasting politics for a year. And I have to practice what it is in my head that brings me peace. And that's a technique that our world today gives you an opportunity to practice about every waking hour of the day.
Yeah, for sure.
That's my favorite.
I like it. I like it. Next question. Do you have a favorite form?
No, I don't have a favorite form, except that every time I watch a video of Jun Ri doing Exodus that he wrote a poem for in the background, and it's done to the music, I weep, because he did it in front of me. His forward thinking to write poetry that accompanies your form and to put it to music. He was a pioneer. But I mean, he would say, you know why martial arts is beautiful in every culture despite language disparities, and is because it's all about movement and lines and circles, and it's beautiful in every culture. And I think that was what he brought to kata. And so I love seeing good katas that aren't repetitive copies of what everybody else is doing. I like to see people bring it, or really traditional kata like done by the JKA, where it's just super precision. And today I appreciate kata not for that it has any connection to fighting whatsoever, but it has every connection to knowing your center, having a good foundation, knowing when to explode, when to be tight, when to be relaxed, you know, how to express and affect people through projection. All these things that are important in life, if you're applying for a job or trying to make a good impression in your business or trying to sell your book, all these things are relevant to that. And posture, and the power of what posture does to your chemicals in your body, bringing confidence. Yeah, I remember seeing a YouTube video of this psychologist talking about how when she's trying to change somebody's attitude, she starts with their body language. And kata's ultimate, you know, superhero body language, where you're just, you know, acting. And it triggers all these chemicals in your body that affect your feelings. So kata in general has come into favor, fallen out of favor, back in favor. I appreciate it now for what it does. And as a senior citizen, I'll be 65 this year. My mobility and my balance and learning how to not fall and get hurt, those are all things that kata benefit. And so I like them all.
I agree. I like it. All right. Two more questions here. Do you have a favorite weapon?
Yeah. Words.
Excellent.
Best weapons, best defense. Excellent. Learning how to articulate your ideas, learning how to oppose ideas, how to add your two cents without doing what I often do, which is, you know, I get angry, say something, and instead of building bridges, you know, it creates walls between us. But learning how to use language and diffuse conflict and say you're sorry. And, you know, and I think that language, compassion, and empathy, those are my favorite weapons.
Very nice. Very nice. All right. And the final question for today, if there was anyone that you could train with, living or dead, fictional or non-fictional, who would that be? And this, you can, although you have a long list of people that you've already trained with, you can include them if you wish. But
I'd train with Kano. I'd love to train with Elio, Hickson. They all had, you know, the one person, I have so many friends that are such good teachers, but Sensei Benny the Jet.
Oh, yes.
What a soulful, experienced, you know, no bullshit guy to train with. But shoot, you know, anybody who's put that much of their life into what they're doing, and we know so many people who have, they're worth spending some time with, you know. And it would have been fun to train with Bruce Lee, see if he was really, you know, he was just a small guy, but man, way ahead of his time.
Mm-hmm.
32 years old, passed away. Yeah. He's already a philosopher, book collector, super high functioning.
Yeah, truly, truly inspiration. Yeah. Yeah. I like it. I like it. Great, great answers. I thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me and, you know, fill me in on your journey, and we'll definitely have to get into
community by telling stories, by talking to people who might not otherwise be heard, of putting this into a format that people a year, 10 years, 100 years from now might actually be able to see. What if we could have interviews with Kano and Ueshiba, mm-hmm. or Musashi, or and hear what they were thinking and what they were working on and how they were training and what was important to them? Oh, your grandfather. What if we had our grandfather sitting down and talking to us about the things that were important to him, or your grandmother? It would just change so much about how we thought about the world. And so you're doing that. You're reaching out to people who you think are accomplished, getting their stories on tape, and who knows who that'll influence down, you know, the well of knowledge is you're expanding it and giving people, you know, instead of hearing about how great Kano was or how revolutionary his ideas were, you could actually hear him talk about it.
Yeah. And that's exactly one of the things that I want, you know, wanted to happen with this is it's great to talk about, you know, these people after the fact, but to hear it from, you know, from the source, that's the way to do it. So, I thank you. Before we close out here, here's your chance for shameless self-promotion. So you can promote anything or just anything else that you wanted to say before we close out here. You have the floor, and we'll go from there. So,
nope. Everybody knows how to reach me. Just search my name on the internet. You can see my art or whatever I'm up to, but I don't think that there's a shortage of information about me online. And thanks to guys like you spreading the word, you know, some of my, you know, I've have so many things that I've adopted in my life that I just heard in one sentence from somebody that I respected. and it made a difference. And I use those. They're like tools I carry around. And so if I can say one thing that somebody goes, I'm stealing that, then I've done my job and fulfilled some of my obligation that I felt that I got from my teachers who were doing what I'm doing now, which was spreading what they thought they knew and what they'd learned from their experiences. So it's a good thing. Thank you again.
All right. Thank you so much for being on. And yeah, we will we'll talk soon. And I can't wait to get this out for all to hear. So thank you again. Thank you for listening to My Empty Hands. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend. If you didn't enjoy it, please share it with an enemy. If you'd like to be a guest, or if you would like to recommend a guest for the show, please email me at podcast@talkingkenpo.com. Thank you.